Good afternoon. It is Wednesday, July 16th. I am your host, Stan Jastrzebski, and this is Ask the Mayor. We're pleased to be joined this week, as we are every third Wednesday of the month, by Bloomington Mayor Mark Rozan. Mr. Mayor, thanks as always for being here.
Thank you.
Before we get started, it is my duty to point out there are a couple of ways you can submit your questions to Mayor Kruzan during our next half hour. If you're near a telephone, feel free to write these numbers down. You can call us at 812-855-0811 or at 877-285-9348. You may also email us both now or anytime, really, at mayor@indiana.edu. Mr. Mayor, I'd like to start this week with the issue of transportation. There's been a study completed that says that a rail line linking Indianapolis and its northern suburbs, a commuter rail line, could be a reality within 3 to 5 years if all of the chips fall as they are planned. And in next month, in fact, a study on a similar line that would link Bloomington with Indianapolis and Muncie is slated to come out. Do you plan to push for such a rail project? I know Bloomington tried hard to get involved on this study as it was first announced. Is this something that's still on a front burner here?
Yeah, it's as you mentioned, we asked to be amended into the initial study that was authored by Representative Terry Austin. And then Matt Pierce, Peggy Welch, and Vice Simpson were working on, and we asked that City of Bloomington be amended into the study. It was initially an Indianapolis-Muncie study, and if the amendment included Bloomington, and Vice Simpson amended it in the Senate, and Matt and Peggy worked on it with Terry Austin in the House. So that study was done. A company, URS, has been doing it. As you mentioned, it will be coming out. The details will be really, I think all comes down to financing. This is one of the most expensive type of projects to do. I think the demand probably increases as we see fuel prices increase. It's not a high-speed rail. It's a passenger rail. It's in the study, and I think that it just in the course of conversation with the Indiana Railroad Company that owns the line, with the consultant who the NDOT, the State of Indiana Department of Transportation, is using, it's pretty evident you've got to have a line that's running at least as fast as what someone could drive. You've got the convenience factor. You've got the fuel savings issue. And to me, on two areas. One is going to simply be how do you finance this? And it will have to – with the cost considerations, we'll have to have federal assistance. You obviously have to have state-local investment. I think the university is committed to making this happen. They want to be able to see their staff faculty be able to be able to move between campuses, but also the student population to be able to – from around the state, be able to access Bloomington. I think – so they will have some financial commitment. That may be in the form of student fees. It's hard to know how else the university could be able to afford to have any kind of investment. The other issue is going to be the connectivity, that you've got to have a way to get to train stations. You've got to have parking if you're there. You've got to have shuttles to it. And so there's certainly going to be a capital investment necessary wherever there is a station. And that I guess is really a third issue, is where would stations be? And in the destination cities, for instance, Muncie, if you talk about Indianapolis, Bloomington, but also stations along the route. Would Martinsville have a station? What has to happen to make this financially work at the same time not make it so inconvenient because you've got so many stops that it slows the whole process down and makes it less attractive to a potential passenger. I've had meetings with the Indiana Railroad Company president and his staff, I think on three occasions. Bill Cook, his son Carl Cook, are extremely interested in this. They're rail enthusiasts, they're historic preservationists, and business people, and this makes sense to them. The university I know that the Indiana Rail and the university have met again recently in talking about this. So if it's going to happen, now would be the time for it to happen. You've got the right people interested. You've got the people who can make things happen there. And it's all going to come down to cost considerations. And then you've got a route selection process. You know, I know it seems almost evident to everyone that it would be the State Road 37 or I-69 corridor would make sense. But Indiana Rail has, I think, and the study, I believe, looked at five potential routes. And again, trying to go through what's the least expensive route to build out. You've got right-of-way issues. You've got clearance issues where there are bridges and there has to be a specific number of feet above the it's an amazing amount of detail that the study encompasses, and all of that has to fall into place for this to work. But I know there are an awful lot of people trying to make that happen.
You mentioned that demand for such a project might have been increasing as we see $4.
That's just, again, a complete layperson perspective.
No. My question is sort of on the other side of this, and mm-hmm. that is that we have a sluggish economy in general. We have stock markets that are losing more and more day by day. I'm wondering if you think perhaps the sluggish economy might push people like Bill Cook to be a little more hesitant towards funneling any sort of significant portion of dollars towards such a transportation project.
Well, it depends. Again, if you're looking, for instance, at the possibility that people are having to and I think we're seeing now in Bloomington, it's an ongoing issue, has been that you can't find the kind of employment that you would like to have in your hometown. And a lot of people are – we have 15,000 people, you know, leaving the community to go to work on a daily basis. So we have people who already are having to rely on employment elsewhere. I think you've got a plan for the inevitability that we're not all going to be able to have our employment center be within walking distance of home. You can't – I think you also have to prepare for the inevitability that you can't afford this certainly not at the kind of fuel efficiency that cars have right now, and the scarcer and scarcer resources and the cost of that fuel. I think you've got to start to retrofit your transportation system. We're meaning the United States is certainly way behind a good portion of the industrialized world when it comes to a modern transportation system. You look at even our major cities really aren't fully equipped, and our big challenge is we will be retrofitting. We're built out as the old school way of roads and highways, relying on vehicles, and it's going to take a huge capital investment to change that. And also, and I think maybe more of a challenge than the money will be human nature. I mean, our habits are pretty well ingrained. We like to have the car. We like to be able to have the convenience of being able to use that car when we want, where we want. And even when it comes to our destination, our instinct is to want to be able to park in front of our destination. There's that whole psychology, and we've talked about on this show a long time ago, where you go to the mall, but you can see your destination point, the entrance at College Mall. If you were to measure out that exact same distance from where you've parked and the entrance to College Mall and put it downtown, it could be 2.5 blocks away, but you can't see your destination. You feel like you're far away and you don't want to park that far away. Our entire mentality will have to change and become more accepting of the fact that we're going to have to rely on different parking models, different transportation models, and this is an opportunity. This is an opportunity to start to make that transformation. And I think, unfortunately, we are spoiled sometimes, even just as Americans. And I think it sometimes takes us being forced to make change. And unfortunately, we've gotten to a point in the world where, in terms of global warming, in terms of peak oil, in terms of the cost of fuel now, we are forced to make those decisions. And this is an opportunity for us to prove we can meet the challenge.
You mentioned retrofitting, and it's funny you use that word. There are some people I've heard who have said, well, why don't we wait on the Beeline Trail development? Maybe we're going to need this for, you know, commuter rail if we're going to have a station, especially in downtown Bloomington. Is that a concern?
It's certainly the economic development benefit of the trail kind of goes to that question you asked a bit ago about the economy and making sure that we're able to make these kind of fiscal investments for transit. The Beeline itself, technically, legally, is still rail banked. I mean, I don't see passenger rail being built out in 3 years, even 5 years would be just an amazing challenge. But if the day comes, and you know, in years from now, technically, it could go back to being rail. When I've met with. I'm trying to be careful not to speak for other people who are in the meeting, but my understanding in the meeting from with Indiana Rail and talking to the consultant was that there are other destination points that they would prefer in Bloomington rather than that. You know, that if you have, like you do in so many cities that have rail service, even up in northwest Indiana and all the way through the South Shore into Michigan City, South Bend, you know, you've got people, commuters who park and ride, essentially. And that's not something we want to be encouraging in the downtown. I mean, we don't want to have massive surface lots for cars to be coming into downtown. You either have to have your mass transportation be set up in a way that people could bus in and then get on a train, or they're going to be driving to their station or walking if they're within walking distance. And I think you'll see interest being put in areas that are to the little bit of north of downtown and possibly to west and possibly both sides of town.
That's something I was going to ask is, do you think something like that might facilitate or exacerbate or whatever verb you'd like to use the expansion of the west and southwest side of town?
I think that expansion is occurring, and this would serve that as I'm not sure. It's a very good question in terms of whether it would propel it or not. Again, I'm choosing which verb you want to use. I suppose that's possible. For me, the bottom line comes down to, you know, we should have this country, you know, should have been in a position where we have this kind of service available already. We don't. This is something that's needed, and I think will make economic sense. That initial capital investment will be the real challenge, and all the decisions. And that's you make a good point, a good question in terms of what is the result, not of what if is a chicken and egg thing, or the horse and the cart, I suppose, is a better analogy of, you know, does the location drive what happens, or is it what's happened have to be served by the line, and you have to adapt to it. But I think absolutely. We're already seeing, you know, you look at the number of people who are working on in industries on the west side of town. We've got issues already with Bloomington Transit not being allowed to serve some of those areas, including in Ivy Tech and some of those west side industries, Cook Pharmica, others, because they're not within the city limits. And they have federal regulations that prohibit them from serving outside their service territory is limited. And I see this as being a blend of all of our system of paths, bike routes, pedestrian routes, our street system, the transit system, getting people to rail service, and I hope that it will help our economy and reverse as well. It's not just people trying to get to Indianapolis. We do tend to think of it as how do we get to Indy. It can work in reverse. I mean, we have a lot of industry. We have a lot of need for a prepared workforce, a trained workforce that we may be tapping into the Indianapolis and the donut counties and bringing people to Bloomington to supply a labor force for industries that we have now and for industries we haven't even imagined are going to exist.
We've got a number of emails. I want to get to them if we can. Paul writes in about tenants' rights. He says that he and perhaps other people he knows have had troubles with the city saying that the expectations of tenants are unreasonable with respect to what is expected in return of landlords. And he says that the city, in his mind, needs to do better in the way of its renters. What is your reaction to that?
Well, I'd have to know, you know, obviously what the desire to have changed is. We have the housing and neighborhood development. I can tell you we hear from landlords who feel that we're too aggressive on landlords, and we end up in court sometimes on some of those cases working on behalf of tenants. Tenant-landlord law is something I worked on for most of my years up in the legislature, and I know Matt Pierce has been a leader on that. State Representative Matt Pierce has been a leader on that in recent years in the legislature. It's tough going. Tenants aren't organized in the way that that landlords might be. But ultimately, it comes down to rights and responsibilities on both parties' part. And tenant-landlord law is primarily set by the state legislature. A community can adopt its own code, which we have, and you know, we've increased the number of hours that we dedicate in the staff time and full-time equivalents, FTEs, in our budget over the recent years to increase enforcement. So it's certainly something that the city council could take up if there are specific issues. But you know, I think we do a pretty good job at it, and the state legislature ultimately would have to change some of the laws in order to beef up the enforcement abilities.
Another person on that general topic writes that she's concerned that many of the apartment complexes do not have recyclables pickup, and especially in a city where there are so many environmentally conscious residents. Is this something that you're hoping to work on to get those people recyclables pick up?
It's something we've looked at almost every year, and every year it comes down to money. We lose money by both in trash and recycling. I mean, the cost, the more we're providing, the more money we're losing. Some people will recall that we increased the price of the trash sticker to encourage recycling, and I think that's worked because our trash sticker revenue has declined even though that price was increased. And some of it does deal with liability issues, our trucks on private property. Some of it deals with the fact that private property has been not built to public infrastructure standards, so the trucks fitting in is an issue, hitting cars in the parking lots, things like that. That's an issue. It's not to me the issue. The issue comes down to the cost considerations that go into it. It's absolutely something that I want to address. I think it might have to come down to regional drop sites and working with the Solid Waste Management District to try to make something like that happen.
Another person writes in, and just a reminder, you can get in on the conversation. Email us at mayor@indiana.edu, as these people have, or call us at 855-0811 or 877-285-9348. Person wants to talk about the recent case involving a local business owner who had troubles with his balloons, violating perhaps the city's sign ordinance. Obviously, this case was eventually dropped by the courts. This sign ordinance has been the cause of quite a bit of discussion in the last couple of years, whether it be large billboards on 37 or whether it be down to one business owner's balloons. And this person wants to know, do you really think this should be enforced against individuals? Should it be enforced against just businesses? Are we at a point where we should look at how this ordinance is written and perhaps revisit it?
Yes. And that's why and I understand what you mean, that the courts technically do drop the case. We the city asked for this one to be dropped. In my mind, there's no doubt that there was a violation of the sign ordinance. Whether it should be or not is the question. It says very clearly in the sign ordinance a list of things that are prohibited, and balloons is actually specifically mentioned. It's not something that was a matter of interpretation of, well, is this signage or not? I mean, it says balloons, streamers, other things. The other issue that I want us to address is maximum fines. In this case, I think the fine could have gone as high as, I believe, $96,000, because there's no cap. And so every day is a violation. And so it just keeps escalating. And I think that erodes the credibility of enforcement of the sign ordinance. You know, the reverse of this is people – when you hear that in a vacuum, it sounds silly, and in some ways it is. On the reverse end is we do get neighbors, residents of Bloomington who will see advertising, whether it be balloons or streamers, and if they, especially when they start to get older or weathered after a rainstorm, whatever it might be, then the complaints start to come in of why aren't you enforcing that they've got advertising, you know, that, that is interfering with the, you know, my enjoyment of the neighborhood. So it's trying to find that balancing act. And I'd like us to see if we can't reach that. This is a relatively new sign ordinance. The balloon issue and the, I think another issue that this author of the email writes in is a very valid one. Enforcement on business and or individuals is having balloons tied to your mailbox for a birthday celebration the same as advertising if you're, in this case, a landlord who's trying to advertise to potential tenants. Again, in my mind, that's clearly advertising. It wasn't celebrating anything other than let's hope that somebody signs a lease. If you're celebrating at home for a victory in an athletic event or a birthday, I do view that as a different animal. But under the current ordinance, it would be treated the same. And I think that's something that needs to be addressed, and we have to fine-tune that sign ordinance. Working with the Chamber of Commerce was fantastic on helping us with the adoption of the sign ordinance. You know, again, the people who enforce the code are – that's their job is to go out and enforce the code. They don't write the code. The code was written initially proposed by staff. It is reviewed and rewritten by citizen members of a plan commission. Then it has to go to the elected members of a city council and becomes law, and then the matter of enforcement. So I think the bad press tends to fall on the people who write the ticket and then who have to go to court to defend the ticket when someone clearly doesn't care what the law says. And that's not real fair. It's an awful lot of citizen input, hours of debate that produced a huge document of which balloons is one word. So I understand the frustration that some can have, but I do think that there is also the other side of it, is trying to protect quality character of the neighborhoods in Bloomington, and looking for a balancing act is what we're going to try to do.
I want to get to a caller we have on the line. Steve is on the line. Steve, I understand you'd like to talk about this balloon ordinance.
Yeah, I'm kind of worried now. If I go to one of the art openings, they have balloons outside there, and it's a business. Are they going to be cited? Will we be arrested if we go to an art opening where there's balloons outside and there's probably usually a lot of balloons at Lotus? Should we be worried or be cautious about going to Lotus and these art galleries that have balloons?
Now, which part of the question isn't sarcastic and which part is
– observant. How does that really affect the galleries? They're a private business and they can put out balloons and stuff like that.
Right. That's a very legitimate question. That's exactly what I'm saying, is that technically they can't. I mean, under the law that is written right now, it says very specifically what is prohibited. That's a process that went through – hours and hours of public debate, public consideration, public members of boards, elected members. So that's what the product was. I think there's certainly discretion when it comes to enforcement. And in this case, I think the discretion, you know, when we get to a point where it could be a $96,000 fine for a balloon, it erodes the credibility of the entire sign ordinance.
Yeah, it's like almost a skit for the Daily Show.
Right. Exactly. So we pulled back. So we pulled back on that one, and I think it was a good way to draw attention to the issue. And I think there are a lot of things in the code that probably lend themselves to this kind of problem. So this is a perfect example, because I want to be having businesses be able to promote themselves. I want, you know, you mentioned the art galleries. I want downtown to be a destination attraction.
Yeah.
And so we've got to find a balance of how we do this.
Yeah.
And I think your question makes the point very vividly that this no one will be arrested because there's no misdemeanor offense there, but certainly there are civil infractions, and that can add up to huge amounts of money, and that's not the goal. The goal is not fine collection. The goal is trying to preserve the quality, the character of the community, at the same time allow people to have what I think are pretty reasonable celebrations or reasonable advertising.
Yeah, you don't want to get to where Bloomington is a balloon-free environment.
There you go. Yeah. I like it.
Thanks for your call, Steve. We appreciate it.
Okay.
before we end the program today, in the last few minutes, I want to talk about you know, Barack Obama and the goodwill of the Democratic Party. You said the other day that you thought that Senator Obama might do well based on the fact that there's a growing perhaps trend or tide of sort of blue sentiment in this very red state. And I'm wondering less about Senator Obama's chances in your mind and more about what happens. I sort of want to flip the question for a second and think about, we've had a lot of tension with respect to the county auditor recently. Both Sandy Newman and Amy Gerstmann are Democrats, and they're running against Vivian Bridges, a Republican who's been very, very quiet as this case has gone to court in a couple of different ways. I'm wondering if you think that any of the goodwill generated by the Obama campaign might be eroded in some way by people being tired of the Democratic infighting in the auditor's race.
Well, first of all, I want to say Barack Obama is a pro-balloon candidate. And I think people should know that. No, I hadn't even imagined that. In fact, I think the opposite would be true, is the ripple effect of the Obama campaign, the fact that it's that Democrats are far more energized, is far more infusion of volunteer hours, dollars. I think it will and the Jill Long Thompson campaign, again, I don't think they'll ever be able to compete financially with the Daniels campaign. I know that, that probably shouldn't be saying that, but I just don't believe it's possible to compete dollar for dollar. But I do think the energy, especially given the Obama presence in the state, will make a difference. And I, you know, if I'm Vivian Bridges, I'd be doing exactly what she's doing, is to stand back. And but I think the judge yesterday has really kind of helped clarify that race and who's going to be on that ballot. And, you know, we move forward from there. I certainly think that there is issues there that will be debated, but I don't know. I can, you know, go to specific races in the past where you would think, gosh, that person just doesn't have a chance against a big name, or because there have been problems or whatever. But in the end, you know, it's going to be a matter for voters to decide. I think that they will separate the issue of who they're voting for president, governor, or county auditor.
Speaking of the auditor, in our last minute or so here, back on Auditor Newman, how much has the city had to juggle its budget recently as her office has tried to you know, make sure all of its numbers tally correctly and different amounts of money than were supposed to go to the city or to local school districts were in fact found out to be in error?
Well, you know, again, we're not completely certain that they're in error. And I want to note, it's my first opportunity to say so publicly, that Sandy came in yesterday and very, you know, to very specifically address some of the concerns we've brought up, and we've appreciated. It's not that we believe it's a $100,000 difference between the funds. We believe the money may be in the wrong accounts. Luckily, those are what are called non-appropriated accounts that don't have to be dealt with in the budget. What does have to be dealt with in the budget is how much money is available to the city in its bank account. And the question of exactly what that dollar amount is gives us pause, but we believe it's such a small dollar amount. It's certainly a principle of the thing, but it doesn't really impact the overall adoption of this particular budget.
All right. Well, we'd like to, as always, thank our emailers. You can still email us, mayor@indiana.edu. We will be happy to collect those emails, both for Mayor Cruzan or for Mayors Armstrong or Goodnight or Bennett as the weeks move on. I would also like to extend my thanks to our callers today and also to the folks in the booth pushing the buttons to make us sound like we know what we're doing, to engineer Michael Pashkash and to producer Colin Bishop. Mayor, thanks as always for being here.
I appreciate it.
And once again, I am Stan Jastrzebski. Thank you for tuning into this edition of Ask the Mayor.